my file down here. I'm the good thief. I'm here for petty theft. You understand? Checks. I'm gonna get crucified now.
So I don't know what happened since then.
I'm always fucking loud.
Okay.
Sorry, that's just the way I am.
Not you. I mean, the proverbial you or something.
Do any of us really know who we are?
I have no idea who I am.
All right.
This actually isn't Alan. This is just the little boy that lives in Alan's mouth.
Okay, that's why.
Alan Jackson. Yeah. What's going on, man?
How are you guys doing?
Doing all right.
Yeah. Happy to be here. I'm actually awake today. I've been up since 8:30 this morning. I treated it like a work day. Went out, been digging up some land behind the house to start a garden. Then I did the Anthony Peake interview. And now I'm here. It's pretty much been everything back to back.
How'd the Peak interview go?
I think it went very well, actually. I was a little nervous, but I think it went well.
Why were you nervous?
I don't know. I get nervous sometimes.
It's okay. Talk about your feelings, Alan.
I don't know.
Does a podcast every week, or is this?
He does a monthly podcast.
Dude, very nice.
Yeah. Basically, it's like we've been planning this for a year. And I don't know. I just had a lot of time to think about it. And then, like, I feel like he always comes across, like, really on his game. And so I didn't want to show up and be, like,
He's got that killer accent, so.
I know, man. Right? It's not fair. It's not fair. That's why I feel like.
Should we have accents to the show? Should we all adopt one?
Yeah. I feel like I'm destined to always sound like a schmo. And, yeah, well, whatever. Good for, but the thing is, like I said, I feel like he is a really intelligent guy, so he sort of lives up to the accent. But I feel like you could say the most inane thing with that voice, and it's going to sound like, oh, wow.
Huh. He wrote some books. What did he write?
He wrote Is There Life After Death? He wrote The Labyrinth of Time. He just put out a biography of Philip K. Dick that he was asked to write by a publishing company. So he's gotten to be a huge dickhead in the sense of a Philip K. Dickhead.
Huh.
Yeah. He also wrote a book called The Daemon.
I haven't read anything of his, but his name keeps coming up. I'm not as familiar.
Do you have Sync Book 2?
What's that?
Do you have the Sync Book Volume 2?
I do. He's in there.
Yeah, you could read something of his. Call me back in 20 minutes.
Maybe I read it. Which chapter did he do? Probably did read it.
Chapter 25, I think.
Let's see.
Yeah, 25.
What is it called? What was the title?
Synchronicity and the Law of Large Numbers.
Oh, yeah, I read that. I actually read that through parts of that a couple times. I read the whole thing and read parts of it again. Yeah, no, it's good. It's awesome.
Yeah, he deals a lot with like precognitive dreams, near-death experiences, things like that. You know, it's really interesting. It's basically, it's like, it's kind of like what we're doing, but trying to do, reach out to people and get their experiences. You know, so like we're talking about like, oh, did you see in this piece of media, blah, blah, blah. Well, he's actually going out and speaking to people. He does like in England, he does something, which is he calls the Walker Group, which is like a bunch of people meeting. I think it's once a month at an art space in England, and all like a bunch of people who are fans of his books come together, and they all talk about these things, and people share stories and stuff like that. And then he, you know, or he'll collect stories from people and kind of see how these types of things, like try and find out what are people actually experiencing.
Do you know why it's called the Walker yeah. Group?
I believe it's like the Walker Art Gallery is where they meet.
I immediately thought of The Walking Dead and how the zombies on there, they refer to them as the Walkers.
Oh, really?
So is there life after death for the Walkers?
That's fascinating. Wow, that's fascinating. I've never seen the show, but yeah. I said I think it's because that's the art gallery they meet at is called like the Walker Gallery or something.
Hmm.
2 hour show, 1 hour show?
1 hour show.
Packed?
I hope so. I feel like it was like a brush to get it all in there, and then I made all these notes of things that I kind of wanted to discuss with him, and I got through like a fraction of it.
Hmm. What did you go into?
Man, you'll be able to hear it in like a few hours. No, I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I thought maybe we could, you know, touch on some of the same stuff if it's what's you're already on.
There's actually something that I wanted to really get into, and it was something that I was willing to put on the chopping block because I thought this actually might be the better venue to discuss it. If you're open to it, there is actually an area I'd like to approach. Specifically, Andros and I have had a bunch of conversations over the few years that I've known him, and he mentioned it again. I don't know if you listened to him. He was on 42 Minutes this Tuesday, and he mentioned it. And it's this idea, you know, it's sort of like all the Kantian angle, right? You have the 9/11 Stargate. This is the 9/11 marks the time when, you know, we go beyond the infinite, right? Mm-hmm. And Justin Morgan has every time I've spoken to Justin Morgan about this sort of stuff, he keeps reminding me, well, sure, 9/11 happened then, but that's also really when the internet started to take off.
Mm-hmm.
And it's less of a this singular like event in New York City, and more like this global interconnectivity of media and computers and things like that. And you know that I'm sure you can guess what my answer is. It's both, right? You know, it's like, well, yeah, that's absolutely true. But you have this huge singular event that now everyone can see. Everyone mm-hmm. around the world can see it within minutes. They can see it on their fucking phones. They can record it on their cell phones. They can whatever. This is an event that everyone can share and replay over and over and over again and dissect. This is why 9/11 is really the first, let's say, false flag, or the first, you know, like there were tons of theories around the Oklahoma City bombing, but those were more underground conspiracies for a long time. You know, the conspiracy circles and this like quasi-patriot movement would share their videos like through like VHS tapes and through the mail and, you know, different like little you know, there were ways to spread the information, but not the same way. With 9/11, you have, here's an event that, you know, unless you want to go to the route of, oh, it's all faked video, which I know a lot of people do, but I'm just saying, like, not going down that road. You have an event that's on film that everyone can watch over and over again and analyze the fuck out of and go, hey, this seems inconsistent with the official story. Oh, you know, the fact that, what was it, CNN showed Tower 7, it said Tower 7 fell 20 minutes before it actually happened. Well, now we have a way that we can all go and watch that clip on YouTube. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's this combination of the event that everyone wants to pay attention to at the same time, or that we have an excuse to all pay attention to the same thing at the same time, but you can only do so because of the internet. So regardless, this is the idea of what is the real Stargate moment? Is it 9/11 or is it the internet? And so Andras has spoken to me a number of times along very similar lines. When we were talking about the whole Suicide Kings thing, and he's like, well, think about it. It's like JFK is happening when everyone has a television in their home, you know, essentially for the first time. It's like around this period that everyone's has a television in the home. And of course, JFK is this assassination that was captured by Zapruder. Whether or not you think, again, is that faked footage? Not going down that route. This is something that everyone can look at again and again and again and can see it on their television screens and etc. So it's the idea that, like, where the moon launch marks a moment or 9/11 marks a moment, yes, but they're also marked by the media. They're also marked by the media format that is being developed and widespread. Can you mute that? You know what I'm saying? So you have the idea of these events are not only huge events, but they're events marked by the media around them. And Bill, you're a big fan of Marshall McLuhan. So what I wanted to kind of do is speak to this event and speak to this idea. I said, I don't know if you heard Andras's thing on 42 Minutes, but he worded it in such a way that it was great, and it just got my mind firing again. I actually think about this quite a lot, but it's the idea of, if the medium is the message, you know, but there's also something that we are in, our generation and even the generation or two before us, are in really strange territory, because it's only been in the last, say, 100 years that you can record events. And as a show called Always Record, we are really experimenting with something very profound. You know, what is the effect of recording a moment in time, being able to revisit it, essentially time traveling or bottling a moment in time, and how does that affect consciousness, and how does that play out? You know, all these questions that come up around it. And Bill, I wanted to, you know, we can go deep into this if you guys are willing, but I wanted to start off by asking you, Bill. Marshall McLuhan has made the point that, you know, when people talk about McLuhan, they're almost sound like he's glorifying media. Now that we have the TV, we're back to a tribal community, or we're back to, you know, we're out of the linear trap of type. But I've seen interviews with McLuhan where he said, you know, people seem to think I'm saying this as a good thing, and it's not necessarily.
Bill?
Yeah, I'm there. Okay. The Gutenberg galaxy, the spectrum of effects of print, the linear, homogenized, industrialized reality, right, which enslaved us through one perspective, could also be, you know, the technology necessary to allow us to cross into a new world. So I think that the retribalization that the internet affords is at first going to be a psychotherapist, because the effects of leaving the Gutenberg galaxy are still with us. So if we are in the space beyond the Gutenberg galaxy, there are the walking wounded. There are the walkers who are still enslaved by the effects of a Gutenberg galaxy. So you have a sort of that sort of transitionary period, which was like Homo sapiens and Neanderthals, where there was a time where they coexisted. But where that was genetic programming that was dividing the people, this is sort of possibly open source code. This is psyche. This is psychology. Are there ways that – are we going to exploit the people who are still stuck in the effects of the Gutenberg galaxy, or are we going to raise them up? It's obviously very complex. Is that kind of where you're looking to, Alan?
Sure. I mean, I guess, and then the question I have about what McLuhan was saying is it even, you said, like, are we going to raise them up? And I guess it's the question of, do you see it as a raising, or is it just merely a, you know, it's different. It's apples and oranges. You know, do you want to be enslaved by the Gutenberg galaxy of linear type, or, you know, do you want to get lost in the Indra's net of, you know, non-linear? I'm not trying to put a negative spin on it. I'm actually just asking. Like, since McLuhan makes the point every now and then, I don't necessarily mean this is a good thing. I'm curious what you think he meant by that, or if you think, you know, certainly being freed from the Gutenberg galaxy is a good thing. The question is, are we just, you know, rebuilding a new thing we'll have to escape from, or?
Well, that's like the Orson Welles, Aldous Huxley juxtaposition, right? You have Orson Welles is concerned about withholding information from the public and keeping people in the dark and needing to find information, while Aldous Huxley's concern about the future was just a complete overload of so much information that nobody's able to distinguish what's what and where's where, because there's just...
Right.
Yeah, it's no one knows which is which and who is who anymore.
I assume you're talking about George Orwell, is what you meant.
Did I say that? Did I say something else?
I think you said Orson Welles.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I was just talking about Orson Welles yesterday for a while, so that's probably where that came from.
Not a problem. I just wanted to verify that's what you meant. So
Orson Welles did the recording of his take on the 60s, 50s and 60s from a biblical angle. So he reads it like it's the book of Genesis. If you haven't heard that, I'd highly recommend it.
I'd like
anyway,
to hear that.
Sorry.
That sounds great.
Okay, sorry, go on.
But yeah, exactly. So like, if we're leaving the Gutenberg galaxy and heading for, you know, the Steve Jobs galaxy or, you know, something like that, is that... I'm really not trying to just put a negative spin on it. It's more of a question. I'm curious how you interpreted McLuhan's.
I'll say this: I think that every child born into this age post Gutenberg galaxy should not be thrust into the. Okay, how do I say this? There's something like bricklaying, the bricklayer of the Gutenberg galaxy. That's what print is. It's one word after another after another. And the cement that binds the brick is your cognitive ability, right? You need to be able to take each letter, put them into the form of a word, but it's your cognition that takes that from five letters into a word, into a thought. And you need to be able to do that. So, like, every child needs to, like, the Gutenberg galaxy needs to be the Gutenberg school, but much like a Masonic initiatory kind of structure, they give you the keys to your release at the end, at the higher grades, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So we know what the Gutenberg galaxy is. We know what it leads to if you don't have the way out. World War, World War II, atomic insanity. But now that we have the keys to the castle, we really have to kind of structure your society based on some of those occult models, in that, you know, adulthood needs to really become a structured environment once again. And, you know, I think McLuhan discusses how schizophrenia is a byproduct of print. He alludes to that in the Gutenberg Galaxy, the book. Do we feel like we have the solution or the cure for schizophrenia?
And how ironic is it that he's writing a book about, like, do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
He's expressing.
Yeah, the poison is the cure sometimes.
Yeah.
But they say that came from cats. You know that theory? That the cats in England, that everybody, that there's a parallel between specifically where schizophrenia first started showing up and when people first started having house cats. And there's an explanation that it was the cats eating the mice or the rats. And there was something to do with the fucking, there was a cycle that was happening with the urine or whatever of cats and the rats.
There is a theory that being around cat urine can actually cause schizophrenia.
Well, the reason was is because they know that there was a, like, it's like a parasite that goes into the cat's brain that keeps the cycle going, and they're aware of it in cats. And so they were saying, what's to keep this same parasite from existing in human beings? And if it were to exist in human beings, what would be its expression? And so that was how they came up with that. Kind of strange. But that's another tip.
You know, with the idea of medium is the message, to bring Philip K. Dick into this, I think for me it's most eloquently illustrated in The Divine Invasion, where I think Philip K. Dick is trying to communicate the concept that the Torah is a technology, that the message of the Torah expressed through Judaism or the Hebrews through those people is the virus, right? That's kind of irrelevant. That will fade away in time. But the actual construction of the Torah put into a book that can be given to another human being, it's essentially giving them a two-dimensional computer. And when you allow your brain to come into contact with the Torah, you are basically uploading a program of conscious cognitive ability. And so it's the medium, it's the structure of it, the architecture of it, that really was the most important thing there. It could have been expressed in a multitude of different, you could have taken the message in a million ways, but it was just getting a book into as many people's hands so that when a brain looked into it, you had brains all throughout the globe looking into the same computer program. So then you get your morphogenetic field, and then you have your conscious evolution, and that was what carried us out of the desert.
So in the same way, like the idea of, yes, the internet was the medium, but the idea of 9/11 being the thing that everyone focused on. Like, now you have an excuse to all focus on the same thing. The 9/11 event being the text of the Torah, and the internet being the book itself, something like that?
Exactly. So the thing that drove the internet was pornography and tragedy.
Yeah.
You know, it's
tragedy,
sex
and
violence.
And hope.
I mean, it's as textbook as you can get.
It's totally, it's tragedy and hope. It's like, Wow, I'm so glad I wasn't in that building. Wow, I wish I could fuck.
Terribly, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, do you think that there's something to be said for the Millennium Hilton as the monolith bearing witness, being itself the internet, being our own reflection through technology, staring back at our tragedies or the tragedy of our existence?
I think that's the beauty of our universe. That's the what the fuck giggle, right?
It's the fact that there's this this collapse taking place, and it's expressing that there's a simultaneous movement that is the internet, that's our amount of connection. So even we're building synchronicity around it. The internet itself is literally like a web of alignments, right? And so we all can get on our different pages, and explore things from different angles through that medium. But we ourselves are playing that out on multiple levels. Like the internet is simply further extension or emanation of a process that's already going on. It's like thought externalized, right? So I'm having kind of a reoccurring, a fresh insight taking place after laying out the arcana in the vesica, being that there's, I don't know if Billy, I had a crazy revelation around tarot the other night, and it just so happened that it was right as Alan was asking me to record a little something to contribute concerning the Crowley's Lust card or the Rider's Strength card, right? And so I decided, after looking at the Book of Thoth and seeing that Crowley had arranged the cards that have astrological associations in a vesica to express that there's a, his rationale for moving that card had to do with, he wanted a complete circle of the zodiac through the arcana. And the only thing stepping between that happening was justice being Libra and strength being Leo. And so Leo is the center of the zodiac. So he moved that card. But if you lay the arcana out as a vesica Pisces, you have the Fool on one end, and then when you do that, you have Lust on the other. And so there are these two sides, and so it gets really interesting, because there you have, the Fool, which is zero, and then you have the Scarlet Woman and the Beast and the Sun on the opposite side. So it becomes, if you look at the structure of the arcana as the structure, as the foundation of the Tower of Babel, then that card at the end, which is Lust, becomes the cornerstone of the structure. And so, but what's really interesting is that if you go along and you look at it in terms of rows, like the first card in the series that has an astrological association, I believe, is the Emperor, and that's Aries, right? And so right below that, when you lay out this arrangement, you have the Moon is Pisces. So you have the first and the last are right in alignment. And if you go down the row, every card lines up in that way, except for one exception. And that exception is the Lover's card, which is Gemini, which is at the top. And then directly below that is the Tower. And so you have, and the entire picture is an eye. And so as a vesica, but you can see when you look through the Book of Thoth that he keeps mentioning in multiple places, the Eye of Shiva, which he says that you have the card Fortune, which is related to Jupiter. He says that the Wheel of Fortune is literally meant to be the Eye of Shiva. And then he has the Eye of Shiva, which is also the Eye of Horus, above the tower itself. So that when the eye opens, the universe is destroyed. But what's really interesting is you look at, well, what was the foundation of Rome with Romulus and Remus? Like, Rome is named after Romulus. Those are two male twins. So whenever I looked at the Lover's card and I saw two male twins, I always thought of Cain and Abel, right? But it's not Cain and Abel. It's fucking Romulus and Remus, which are mentioned in the Book of Thoth briefly, but still mentioned. And so these twins, which are suckled by the wolf, they were born from Mars. They're Mars's children that he had with a virgin. So, like, Mars is associated with the tower. So you have this connection of Mars, the fucking tower, to Gemini with the twins. And so, literally, like, when you're looking at the two towers, which also appear throughout the tarot, in the Rider deck, you can see them in Death card, the 13th Arcana. But then they still appear in the Moon card, which is Pisces, right? Which is the end of the cycle. So I find it really, really interesting just to go into, like, looking at the tower through the lens of Gemini leaves you with two towers. And to have those towers collapse is literally, like, symbolically, like, the expression of, like, of the fall of Rome, essentially. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. And just to give you a quick thing, the idea of if it's the fool at the top and the and lust at the bottom, you have the idea of what is the strength card, lust card, is the idea of this sort of rising kundalini. So it's like trying to reach up to that zero point energy field expressed by the zero of the fool. And the fool is stepping out over a cliff. So he's we already know he's up high. Now, King Kong, who has been on the Twin Towers in the 1970s, King Kong, the word Kong in Chinese means zero. So you literally have King Kong falling to ground zero. So
oh my God.
Yeah, so
and
Kong
it's
on the
perfect
ground
too.
Is ground zero.
Oh my God. And so, wow, that's fucking good. I'm glad you said that. And so, and then this brings up so much, like, and this is why I'm glad I wrote this all out. It just flowed. Like, when it came, it was just like complete download. I was just typing like nonstop, and there was, and then I'm looking at it and I'm like, okay, that's good. I made a couple errors and I'm going to record it, but the errors don't interfere at all with the thesis. But yeah, so you have, it's the 11th Arcana, right? So if you're saying 11, KK, right? So symbol for, okay, I wrote this down. I was watching Secrets in Plain Sight, Scott Onstott, and he literally, he says that, you know, so that image, this has been on my mind a lot, because I noticed it in multiple places, but one of them being, if you see the Dr. Parnassus, you know, the symbol that gets written on, there's a few symbols, one of them is Phi, but the symbol that gets written on Heath Ledger's forehead is literally a mirrored K, right? It's an X with a line through it, which is Ze, as a Semitic letter, which literally means beetle. There's a triangle and a circle around this double K. And so I look at that symbol and I see KK, and so it's been on my mind. But then I'm watching Scott Onstott's video, and he says that that is literally the hieroglyph for the risen sun god Horus. And it also means land of the spirits. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at it and you're like, what happens with Heath Ledger is he literally gets resurrected, and he is the hanged man. And so on both sides at the corner, at the cornerstone of this arrangement, where you have lust, you have fortune above it, which pictures Typhon moving as one of the three Unas from Samkhya, moving off of the wheel, and he's holding an Ankh downward. And the card directly below that is the Hangman, where he hangs from an Ankh by a serpent. He's held there by a serpent. Typhon, in the card fortune, the bottom half of him is a serpent. And so you have a serpent and an Ankh directly above, thus strengthening the relationship of the arrangement, right? So I was going to go further with that, but basically you can see that it's expressing a reversal in the first place. First, it's expressing a turning by it being a wheel, and then it's expressing that it's flipped by having it the hanged man. And so Heath Ledger himself is the hanged man, but then he's also identified with Horus. Now, Crowley says that his eye, that is the eye of the Wheel of Fortune, is literally Horus, the eye of Horus, at the same time as being the eye of Shiva. So you have this being emphasized in such a direct way. It's really incredible.
Now, once you consider, so the medieval idea of the Wheel of Fortune, the Rota Fortunae, is the idea that you have this king kill playing out on the wheel. So at the top of the wheel, you have the king sitting on the throne, on the right side of the wheel, he's falling. On the bottom, he's like kind of like crawling. And on the left side, he's climbing back up. And it says, like, I have reigned. My reign is over. I will reign again.
Right.
Right. So you have this idea of that playing out. Now, I want you to consider this. This obviously relates to any kind of sun god, because every night the sun god dies and then is risen again in the morning. But there's also this, like, when you say it's this and that, the idea of that KK being sort of mirrored within itself inside the circle, inside the triangle, there's the classic alchemical motif of you see a triangle with a circle with the lovers inside of it. And this is the alchemical symbol for the alchemical marriage. Do you know? Can you picture what I'm saying? There's like, you see like a guy standing there and he's holding the compass points open, and there's the triangle and a circle, and then the two figures inside of the circle. So the idea of the Gemini twins, you know, being, whether they're twin brothers, in a sense, being a mirror of yourself, but they're also the, you know, the alchemical marriage, the idea of you and your feminine side, or you, you know, the Godhead and the devil, the shadow and light, all these sorts of things are being played out inside that circle in the triangle, which, of course,
right,
everyone knows the circle and the triangle as this sort of eye of providence. So you have, it's just like really tightly all in there.
Right. So the other thing is that, you know, the European occultists emphasize the three serpent letters in certain places, in the Golden Dawn, at least. I've seen this, where they talk about Samech, Tet, and Lamed. And so there's a process of the serpent basically becoming an Ouroboros. And you can see this symbolically represented in the Rider deck, in the Royal Wands cards, where there's a lizard that gets closer and closer to reaching its tail. And so the King of Wands, which is the Lizard King, actually pictures the serpent reaching, the lizard reaching his tail behind the head of the king. And so it's interesting that Lamed relates to adjustment, which is Libra, and that part got switched with the other serpent letter, which is lust, and the one where it actually reaches its tail is Samech, which is temperance, which is the 14th arcana. And so you can appreciate the 14 is emphasized in gematria, being that your fingers in your hand have 14 segments. If you look along your fingers, because your thumb has two and your other four have three, if you add 14, so they there's this weird thing in Kabbalah where they talk about the three hands of God, and it's because if you add 14 plus 14 plus 14, you get 42, which is the 42 letter name, which is in the Tefillin cube. And so then that relates to Shaddai, Metatron, and then you have the cube being the six directions, and then that's the Ah. That's just a whole, that's a big thing to get into.
Wait, please stop there. Think about this for a second. You know, I always come at it from the Egyptian angle, is that Osiris, of course, gets cut into 14 pieces, but the first time he dies, because he gets killed more than once, the first time he dies, Typhon traps him in a box. So you have the idea of the guy representing the 14 pieces being trapped in the box. So this, is this not, If the 42 is really represented as the threefold trinity of Osiris,
oh my God!
Right, who is the 14? But then he goes in the box. He's going into the Tefillin cube.
Wow, that's heavy. So this is there's this whole thing that's just completely I've been obsessed with, that you know, you have Moses is a, you gotta acknowledge he's a prince of Egypt. You know, whether or not you believe in the mythologies or however you want to take it, right? He's a prince of Egypt. And so he's raised with Egyptian philosophy. This is why you look at like the Egyptian creation story, and you can see the parallels between that and Bereshit. And so I can't help but consider, like, he, first of all, comes down with the tablets, which are the Torah. sees the people worshiping a calf, which is the Egyptian religion. These people follow the Egyptian religion. Like, we know that the people who lived, who were workers in Egypt, like archaeologists have shown that they had, you know, Egyptian religious artifacts in their homes, meaning they practiced the same thing, right? Or at least maybe they related to it in a much different way, but still. So I think it's really interesting just to think about, you know, you have this religion itself is like, first of all, he's going down. He's not the way that they say it. I think in the Gemara, as they talk about that they weren't rules, you know, it wasn't like these rules that he was giving them. And he sees what they're doing and they're participating in the same old thing, even though they're liberated. So he's like, I liberated you. So he smashes the tablets. And then the tablets that he gives them are the Torah, which has a slightly semantic issue considering that they include the future. But anyways, it's symbolic in the first place. It's expressing that he's giving them this thing, but it's encoded the truth rather than just giving them the truth. And so they have to till the soil of it before they can reach the truth. And so this is really interesting why you have a fool, which is the ox, and then you have a lamed, which is the ox goad, the tool used to steer the ox. And so this is the literally why you have to till the soil before you can partake of the tree of life, which is once again the Ankh, right? It's a subtle body. Before you can really go to the depth of what the subtle body is and where it leads, you have to till the soil of what the Torah is.
Just a personal sink in here is that I told you this morning I was out digging up some ground. So I live in this apartment building here, and there is what's essentially like a backyard space, and a few of us in the building had talked about trying to make some garden space there. So I went out this morning, we were just like digging up grass and things like that, and you know, the conversation turned to, well, we're going to need to till the soil, even once this is dug up, we're going to need to till it, and like, since it's a sort of a big plot, and it was like, maybe we should all chip in and rent a tiller to kind of run it. It would take, you know, it's a big job. And I spent my morning talking about tilling the soil. It's just a funny little sink there.
Yeah.
And the other, you know, the other sort of the sink that leads to the next step here is that one of the things that we were, of course, talking about was how to set up the rows in which you would plant in. So what do we have but lines of type, right? The rows that you plant in. So first you till the soil, then you set up your rows that, on mm-hmm. which the fruit can grow. So here you have the lines of type or the lines of text.
The soil and the tilling of it would, I think, then relate back to what the human being does in the Gutenberg galaxy. It's presented with this acreage of information sort of expressed as a book, but you must chop the motherfucker up to get it ready for harvesting. And I think of a parable in the Bible where people are given plots of land and how they what they do with the land is then judged by their master or by God. So I think that the last 2 weeks you've really David, you've really kind of explained that idea really, really well. I think it's pretty brilliant with the tilling of the soil as sort of the turning of the letters of the Torah or the sort of the mastication of the food for thought that's presented there.
Well, the mastication part is interesting, even like with everything we're talking about, being that, you know, you have shin is literally the canine tooth, right? And so what's funny is to bring in a little Christianity, you know, it's like, you know, I'm sure we're all aware that Yeheshua is Yud Hey Vav Hey with a shin in the center, which is literally the tool, the thing used for mastication. So to take in the thing and incorporate it into yourself, like what you eat becomes a part of you, right? So this is, and like, you know, you don't want to eat something that's not kosher. It's like you have something that's actually has some substance, and so you take that in, and so, you know, it's food for thought. But
and of course, Jesus is not only the thing that allows you to chew it, but he is the food. This is my body. Eat of it, however it goes.
Exactly. You need canine tooth to be able to chew on somebody's flesh, you know. but then that also, for me, brings up the vampire thing and what the strangeness around, like, Batman, like, as Robert Anton Wilson pointed out, that Batman, the symbol for Batman, you could look at it as vampire teeth, you know, and that in the first Batman, when they're like, they say he drinks blood at the beginning, and they're like relating him to this vampire and that he only comes out at night. But then literally, like, the, you know, if you equate Jesus as saying, drink my blood, you know, and you'll live forever, you know, what does that remind you of? And so there's a really interesting side when you bring that up with that Heath Ledger is the fool, and then how that shows up in relationship to this, you know, to this whole thing we're talking about here. I don't know. It's just weird.
It even goes back to the idea of The Walking Dead, because isn't The Walking Dead a zombie show?
Yeah.
So presumably they're people going around eating flesh.
Have you guys seen Django Unchained?
I have not.
No. What is Django Unchained?
The Quentin Tarantino movie.
Oh, no. It's a new Quentin Tarantino movie?
Well, it came out, I think, in December, so it's about 6 months old. But the movie opens up with a little buggy going across a field, and on top of the buggy is just a big tooth kind of dawdling about. So obviously there's your sheen, right? That's your tooth. And the person driving the buggy is a gentleman with the last name King. He's actually a doctor. He's a dentist, but he is Dr. King. And he meets these slaves who are chained up. And he frees the main character, Jamie Foxx, who is Django. So there's this Dr. King with the sheen, which is the tooth, who's liberating our hero. Which is weird because you have a white German guy named Dr. King, and I think of the other Dr. King who is responsible for liberating a lot of oppressed people. Mm-hmm. And I've also been thinking lately of I forget where I read this, so I'm just wondering if maybe it strikes a nerve in either of you, but you know, the doors of perception are one thing, but the chains of perception are another thing. And that's kind of what we do with sync, are these chains of perception. And I'm just wondering, with a German Dr. King with the sheen that is what makes Yeshua, the Savior, breaking the chains of perception, I don't know. It's a good movie. I sure. think it's pretty filled.
Well, you know, in like Apocrypha, not the Book of Revelations, but I forget which one it is, but there, I think it's actually in a couple of the others, but there's an emphasis that I really love of Jesus's descent into, literally in Greek, Hades, which they don't like to say in English versions that you're looking at, you know, but he descends into the underworld. And it's his ability to endure and bring, like, basically absolute equanimity and forgiveness into the underworld that ends up, like, you know, liberating himself from it. So he's literally, I mean, it's a classic story, right? He's Osiris. So it descends into the underworld. And he's the resurrected, you know, God-man, right? But there's actually a version of it where it's like he's looking upon all these people in hell, and I forget, I guess John is with him, And he asks Jesus. He says, "Well, what about all these people that are in hell? You know, like what's going to happen to them?" And he's like, "Well, don't worry about it. In time, everyone will be liberated from this." And which is really great, because you know that's not a classic idea. That's something that was put on much later. Like he says, there'll be gnashing of teeth or whatever in the gospel, you know. But the idea of eternal hell didn't exist for the Jews. Didn't exist even in Christianity if it wasn't for the way that the canon was arranged and very selective with what it decided to put in there and how it decided to translate things. Hell meant to be a purifier in the same way that I thought it was a Hebrew word for atonement that meant to purge, but it's actually an Aramaic word that we came across in the Zohar. I have it written down somewhere, not in front of me, but it's an Aramaic word for repentance, means to purge, and it's associated with hell, this place that's like refines the being, you know, that you basically purge out what needs to be released, and so that the spirit is allowed to ascend. It's a purifying place. And I that's like something I feel needs to be more emphasized generally when people are talking about it, because all it seems to be is just this endless punishment thing, and it's like that's never what it was intended. And it's even
Dante, who he portrayed hell as being a place of eternal damnation. There was no escape from Dante's Inferno. Nonetheless, he depicts the lowest level as Lucifer, Satan, constantly chewing on the three assassins.
Mm.
Right? They're just constantly being chewed and masticated for all eternity. But even there, like I said, even though he's the one who's saying it's for all eternity, you have this idea of the mastication. And there will come a point where that mastication ends once it's finally refined.
Yeah. Dig it. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just want to say, also, when you were talking about like Jesus going to hell or Hades, I couldn't help but think about when Charlton Heston, who of course plays Moses in Planet of the Apes, there he is. He's in chains for a good part of the movie, and when he becomes Moses Unchained, he's escaping into the Forbidden Land. And what is the first thing that happens when Moses meets Isis? What are his first words that he says?
We blew it up or something? I forget.
God damn you. God damn you all to hell.
Dig it. I was just talking about that to my rabbi. He thought it was funny. Because I was actually just talking about Planet of the Apes, and then my rabbi was like, "Wasn't he Moses?" And then he was like, "That's weird." I'm tripping on that because I was saying that with Dr. Zaius or whoever it was, I guess it was Dr. Zaius who's talking about God created ape in his own image, and that the apes have this other version of the Torah. And how ironic it is that they're quoting from the Torah even in Planet of the Apes when and then he's Moses, you know, it's pretty perfect.
This is all kind of feeding into this, what I've been trying to process out of this season of Mad Men, which is really just a processing of this entire show, Mad Men. But it's interesting that you bring up that scene, Alan, because I think 2 weeks ago, Don Draper, who is this character who is seemingly going through this entire journey, totally informed by the tarot and these kind of concepts. There's a scene where he needs to get out of the house and he takes his son to the movie theater, and the movie that he's watching is Planet of the Apes. So I have to go back and see how that all fits in for me, but it's kind of a bullseye for me right now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, this idea even that the ape, you have the Egyptian ape is a version of Hermes, right? That he's the baboon.
So right.
This, you know, when you were talking earlier about the two snake letters switching places, to me becomes Hermes or Thoth, or, you know, whoever you want to, whatever you want to call him, Mercury. You have this Caduceus, and what is it but the two snakes constantly switching place? They don't just switch place. It's kind of like the Typhon on the wheel. He doesn't just become the Hangman and get resurrected. He becomes the Hangman again, and then he gets resurrected. So these twin snake letters are constantly switching place.
So from an ape to a doctor ape. Like, if you have your operating system of your Torah that's given to the apes, if they use it correctly, they become more intelligent. They become doctor apes. And so there you have your Draper, your doctor aper. Pretty crazy.
Oh, yeah.
But really what this Draper is realizing is because he's at the top floor of the world, he's basically what everybody wants to be. He's realizing that in this operating system, it's a finite operating system. And he's feeling the crush of that he can't see any more future because there's nothing left to be done. And he needs to make the jump to a higher operating system. But he just doesn't have the tools to do it right now. And for me, I've been predicting that this is going to happen through some sort of psychedelic experience. It's had shadows of that possibility.
Well, if he just saw Planet of the Apes, that means he's about a month away from 2001 A Space Odyssey coming out.
The last episode was Bobby Kennedy being shot. So that is...
Oh, but that's later.
June 5th, 1969.
So wait, so he just saw Planet of the Apes.
2 weeks ago in the narrative, in the, where the episode was.
Right. Because... Planet of the Apes, no, because Bobby Kennedy dies after Martin Luther King, because Bobby Kennedy actually made a speech when Martin Luther King died. So that means they skipped right over Martin Luther King because...
They showed, I think Draper goes to the movies in the episode. At the end of that episode, they're at a convention and it's announced that Martin Luther King had been shot.
Right. Now, that's fascinating because Planet of the Apes actually came out a few months before 2001 A Space Odyssey. Now, the day 2001 A Space Odyssey came out was the same day Martin Luther King was killed.
Jesus.
So if it's the same episode, now we've gone through, with Mike Cleveland, we went through all the connections between Planet of the Apes and 2001. But that means if he went at the beginning of the episode to see Planet of the Apes, and at the end of the episode Martin Luther King is killed, you literally have this Planet of the Apes 2001 connection all in a package.
So Planet of the Apes would be the height of the old operating system, and 2001 would be the dawning of the new operating system, where ape turned into Dr. Ape is a progression, but now the Dr. Ape needs to make that leap into the Star Child.
Which they do in Planet of the Apes by going into the Forbidden Zone.
Okay.
What is the Forbidden Zone but going beyond the finite?
Oh, man. You could look at them as reflections of one another, especially because they actually express a loop, because the one ends with whatever... What's the name of that lake and where is it?
Exactly. It's in Utah. Lake, I want to say Powell or something like that in Utah.
Into the lake, if you were to strike it and reverse it, even though one came out first, but look at it as the hero's journey in a continuum that loops back around. When they crash into the water at the beginning of the Planet of the Apes, you could take it as when you go around the rota wheel as the Vesica, that when you come out of lust, you basically fall into the Hangman, which is Mem and water. I don't know.
No, I think I told you guys this when we had Mike Cleveland on, was I had a dream, and in the dream I saw how it worked. Like, you would take these movies, and it was just like, it was flawless to me. Like, I don't know how to explain it, but I saw in my dream that, like, you would take these movies, and there is a way to create a sort of perfect loop. And I want to say, when you say about mirroring each other, you know, we're talking about Martin Luther King being killed. I want to just remind everyone, Martin Luther King, at least in the by James Earl Ray. Well, what is Ray but King? Ray means king. So that's King being killed by King.
Right. There's your golden Ray in The Shining, right?
Uh-huh.
In the storehouse room.
So if Bill, you're thinking to Django Unchained when he's the White King, in a sense, you know, James Earl Ray is the White King. Does that make sense?
Well, I just think it's so fucked up for Tarantino to have the guy who plays the White Dr. King, the movie before he plays a Nazi in Inglourious Basterds, and then he plugs him in into a more sympathetic role to sort of cleanse his actor, who is well known as this Nazi in one movie, and then brings him in and makes him Dr. King, liberator of Django, who is chained.
But I guess what I keep coming back to is that there's very little I'm going to be very careful how I say this, but esoterically, at least, there's no difference between the Nazi and Martin Luther King.
And
In that they're the same. They're two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, they exist because of each other.
Yeah, yeah. The oppressor.
And I think Tarantino is—he's just an insane motherfucker. I think he's underappreciated, and I think he's very brave and flaunting that he knows he's underappreciated. I think that movie is essential viewing. I think there's shitload going on in there. So that's my two thumbs up.
Wait a second. In Tarantino's scene, I've talked about the movie Four Rooms a bunch of times. I'm curious. I mean, I haven't seen the movie in years, but I'm curious to go back and look at it. Now, whether it's intentional or not, you have the Kabbalistic four worlds. So here you have four rooms and you have the four worlds of the Kabbalah. So doesn't Tarantino's thing end with, I want to say, like someone collecting teeth?
Or no, it's a finger.
But it's like a play on an older thing where someone collected teeth.
Oh yeah, he goes across the countryside collecting fingers.
Right, but I'm saying I think there was a. That's Tarantino sort of paying homage to another, like an older movie or something of someone who went across. I'd have to look it up. I mean, I could be wrong, but I think that's the case.
The television show from, I think, the 60s, where they're imitating the television show, and they say it in Four Rooms, like what they're doing. They're like, you know, the classic fucking whatever. And he goes, I'm not a guy going across the countryside collecting fingers. We're friends here, but I'm gonna, yeah. So, still, whatever.
Okay. Well, even still, severing the segments of the finger, what that brings us back to the idea of the 14 pieces of Osiris as the hand.
So here on, right. I don't. I'm kind of tripped. My mind is going like all over the place right now. But if you look at Horse Lover Fat Subliminal Synchrospheres Facebook page, by the way, I talked to this guy and he's interested in being on our show at some point. So
awesome!
Yeah, I'd love to have that guy on.
I'm not sure if he is in Dublin. I sent him a thing this morning asking him if he is, because we might have to do a funny time thing. Maybe
he's in Ireland,
but because he might be. I mean, it says that on Facebook, but I mean, I got friends that say they're in Alexandria, and I know they're in San Francisco. So, he pointed out here, he's got, did you guys see the link there that I dropped? I think you can see his pictures, even if you're not friends with him. But here, you know, I've noticed before that you have the, in A Clockwork Orange, you have the police officers who one is his number is 665 and the other one's 667. And then when you're standing on both sides of Alex, you can see Alex is 666. And so his case number is actually 666. And so they let you know what they're talking about. And so then that makes sense with The Clockwork Orange emphasizing that it's the sun. But what I never noticed until this morning when he pointed it out in this image, one of these images that he has here, is that the only time in A Clockwork Orange when you actually see the sun in the shot is when they're walking down the pathway and they're holding Alex on both sides and he's in the middle. So you have 665, 666, and 667, but then he's making comparisons, and there's plenty of them, between A Clockwork Orange and Pulp Fiction. And Pulp is literally, I'm just realizing this now as I'm saying this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what is in, what is the case number of the case when he opens the case and he's like, oh, it's beautiful, and it's light emerging from his suitcase, right? It's that it's 666 that he types into the thing, and then he opens the case and he goes, oh, it's beautiful. Isn't that fucking interesting? Not to mention that he's got this other one where when you watch A Clockwork Orange and Alex has had the accident, and then they're like showing him the different images, and one of them is, you sold me a crummy watch and I want my money back. And Alex's response is, you know what you can do with that watch? Stick it up your ass. And then what happens in Pulp Fiction, but he holds the watch up his.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
So I posted here for him to look at. I don't know if you guys have seen Rob Eggers' interpretation of Pulp Fiction.
No.
Absolute favorites of his. It's an example of something that's like, yeah, I don't see how this wasn't Quentin Tarantino's intention here, having to do with the significance of the watch and the subtext that's going on with that, and then the fact that Marcellus Wallace is getting raped, and how when Bruce Willis goes and saves Marcellus, he's symbolically saving his father, and so basically Marcellus taking it up the ass is symbolic of his father holding his war watch up his ass. And so,
and what is the watch but a symbol of Saturn?
Exactly.
Right.
And so why it's a war watch. And so the whole thing is that when they made wristwatches, it was for the war. That was where wristwatches came from. It was not fashionable before that. And so every single aspect of this is like totally symbolic, you know.
It's thinking of the idea of like Saturn who eats his children. Sorry, you know, like the idea, like people say, you know, in The Shining, there's the incestuous angle, and the idea of putting a watch up your ass is essentially like putting Daddy Saturn up your ass.
Right. It's also the sun, and so that's a clockwork orange.
That's
the clock. So you could look at it like an eclipse. Everything under the sun is in tune, but the sun is eclipsed by the moon. And so then there's also
what do we call it when you expose your ass?
Mooning. Moonshot.
Yeah.
So what's interesting too is the difference of associations with the Tree of Life, where you have what is Yesod for the golden dawn, but the moon, and then Tiferet is obviously the sun. Which is your 666, right? But the fact that, you know, you have in the old system Jupiter and Saturn where you sowed and hoot. So literally the King Kill is playing out on on this level of form that's the closest to home, right? The cycle between the sapphire pavement, which is Yesod, but then the way that it gets switched is literally Chesed and Gevurah become the sun and the moon. So Gevurah is the sun, and Chesed is the moon. So what happens with the monolith, but it tilts, right? So you see the monolith in one direction in the film, but then you're literally looking at the monolith, which is it sideways. So when you're at the base of the tree, you're looking at this relationship in a very, like, it's removed from the reality of what's taking place. So when you transcend and move to another level up the tree, you literally change directions of the pathways. You could look at that as changing the monolith, and why it is that the dweller at the threshold is the beginning of like Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite. And this is backed up by the fact that in 2001 A Space Odyssey, there's actually four sections to the film, which has been pointed out by multiple people in the same way that there's four sections to the film Full Metal Jacket. But what's interesting with 2001 A Space Odyssey is that every time you go to another level, you're literally going to another planetary level that it corresponds directly to the four worlds of the tree, which is Adonoi once again, because you go Yud, He, Vav, He up the tree. But it starts out on Earth, you go to the moon, you go around the sun. No one flies around the sun, to quote from Pink Floyd's Echoes, which goes in sync with Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite. And then where are you then? You know, you go beyond the infinite, you're moving beyond the abyss. And so that point, the first point at which you see the monolith turn sideways and then disappear into black, and then you go beyond, you're literally moving to the supernal triad at that point.
It's, you know, there's like a lot there, because the idea of the monolith turning on its side and like almost laying, and it kind of like lays flat, it's almost like the barrier is dropping. You know, like here's this like wall, another brick in the wall, and then it's sort of like the toll booth. Oh God, I just made myself crazy by saying toll booth. But you know what I'm saying. It's like basically the toll booth drops, and now you're free to pass through. Well, okay. Earlier I was thinking, if Seferd is the sun, we know is 666, and it's in the center, and then you have Da'at, or the abyss, and the churn zone, the dweller on the threshold, is also represented as 333. So if you're going up and you're passing through 666, then 333, do we expect a 999 on the bottom?
Huh, that's interesting.
There's just a sort of like thought that popped through my head, because I'm not familiar with that. But yeah, exactly. So there's also, I love that you just expressed the monolith as the tree, because when you mentioned the Millennium Hilton before. And what I wanted to let you guys know, I haven't mentioned this, but when we first moved down to Asheville, Melissa went for this job interview at a, like as a waitress inside this hotel restaurant, and it was the DoubleTree Hilton. And so it's another Hilton hotel, and it was called the DoubleTree, and their logo was the letter, big letter D, and if you could picture like the D being like a crescent with then a line coming through. So it was like a crescent and two lines coming down, and both of those lines were trees, but it was kind of like the same shared roots, and like there was like this crossover, so it was almost like a split tree. And I'm sitting looking at this thing thinking of the split tree. You have the split Adam, you have Millennium Hilton and 11, which a lot of conspiracy theorists have laid the claim that the towers were brought down with mini nukes, that it wasn't like even, you know, thermite or things like that. But no, it was mini nukes. Now, whether there's any truth to that or not, you have this idea of the split atom at 9/11 with the Millennium Hilton. Now we have the Hilton double tree, the split Adam. And I look over, as I'm thinking this, I glance over, and do you know what was right next to the fucking hotel? But a TGIF restaurant. Well, thank God it's Friday. When does the Jesus, the split Adam, when does he get killed? But on Good Friday. Thank right. God it's Friday. Fucking crazy.
Yeah, that's weird. Oh, boy.
If you don't have something, I'm gonna run with this. Is that the toll? I just said toll booth, which kind of blew my mind, because that takes this to a whole other level of this sink that's building up for me around the Phantom toll booth. But go ahead.
Oh God! All right, no, that's all I'm saying.
Is this sink has piled up for me? Like the more I thought about it, the more I realized. I don't know if I mentioned this on last week's show, but not only does he have the like Rule 88. Just before he goes through the toll booth, which syncs with Back to the Future. But once he goes through the toll booth, what he meets is this, what's known as the watchdog. And it's this dog that helps him keep track of time. and the dog actually has a clock inside of him. Now, in Back to the Future, the first person or the first living thing to time travel is the dog. Mm-hmm. So he puts, Doc Brown actually puts a clock around the dog's neck and then says, when this baby hits 88 miles an hour, you're going to see some serious shit, which, of course, Sirius is the dog star. So that's a sync I've had for a while. But now I'm thinking that you have the dog with the clock around its neck is going 88. Now this kid in Phantom Tollbooth goes 88, Tollbooth, and then gets the dog with the clock on him. Now I took this a step further when I realized that the kid in Phantom Tollbooth, his name is Milo, M-I-L-O. Well, Michael J. Fox, who is the kid who goes back to the future, went on later to be in Disney's Atlantis, where he is animated. So Michael, the animated Michael J. Fox, right, because the kid in Phantom Tollbooth is a real kid named Milo. He goes 88 through the tollbooth and becomes, he goes into the cartoon world. Well, Michael J. Fox goes 88 miles an hour, Back to the Future, all this sort of shit. He then, when he's animated in Disney's Atlantis, do you know what his character's name is? Milo.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
And then there's The Adventures of Milo and Otis, which is the dog and the cat.
I don't know that. I don't know what that is. That's interesting.
Well, Milo's the dog, I imagine.
Wasn't it? I think Milo and Otis was the one that they got in trouble for killing so many dogs, and it was from dropping it off of a fucking cliff. And they kept on dropping these dogs off of a cliff, and it was that point at which they made them change basically what was permissible in terms of that for taking risks with animals for movies.
So is Milo a cat or a dog?
Milo's the cat, it looks like.
Oh. Milo's a cat. It's a tabby cat, never mind. But still, it's interesting. It's funny that they're at the top of this hill. It's like, in this cover I'm looking at on Wikipedia.
The idea of the dog going off the cliff is, of course, the fool card. He's trying to keep the fool from going off the cliff, but I guess the dog went over anyway. And Otis is the name of the guy who invented the elevator.
Invented the elevator in the first place?
Yeah.
Oh, weird. Oh, like, weird.
If you go, most elevators, if you go into most, any elevator you ever go in, look, it usually says Otis on it. Because guy.
The phone booth elevator that's essentially an elevator that Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure where Neo fucking time travels. Okay.
Yeah. But I guess I was thinking about, you know, going down, you know, an elevator we think of as elevation, but the elevator descends and ascends.
Elevator shafts that everyone reported that the explosions came out of during
that. Right.
Saying it was the elevator shafts. Oh, God, that's fucked up.
Which is, of course, the pillars of the tree. Are you climbing up the tree or coming down?
Wow. Oh, yeah, right. And so that's the whole, oh, man. There's no, this is the issue I was having, which I was trying to communicate at the time, but I didn't do a very good job when we had Jan Irving on, was that there's, like, what I look at with Kabbalah, like, their emphasis is on the descent of the light. And they're not very oriented in terms of like climbing the tree. And when you look at the more of the, I guess, mainstream Kabbalistic school, like what Madonna belongs to, what is it, the Kabbalah Society or something? I don't know what it's called, but they're completely focused on just the ascent. And that's like, I'm sure there's place, you know, it seems like that's more like the European people were very focused on that. They're obsessed about that angle on it. And that was all they were interested in. It's like the serpent climbing up this tree. And it's like up and down, it becomes kind of like meaningless ultimately in the end, because it's not about that. It's about bringing the tree together, reconciling this split, right? You want to take the male and female and allow them to be married, and it's like the alchemical side of it, and that should be the focus. But people like to look at things in an ambitious way or something. It's this other notion, and I can see it because if you look at it in terms of the chakra system, you always think of ascending upward and opening up the third eye. And I've been finding with my personal work that what has been more helpful than anything is bringing my awareness in throughout my body. You know, although I can feel my brain opening up, it's like that's not to be like you're not just it's too cerebral to just focus on that side of it. I can see why like so much occultism ends up being so cerebral. It's because it's so thought based and kind of misses that the point of the work. If you're going to imbue your thought with something actually occurring that's you know real energetically, you don't want to just be thinking about it. You want to bring your awareness into your body, and then that allows something else to happen there. So anyways,
yeah, I mean that was my issue with the Kautsian school, or at least what I perceived was the emphasis of the Kautsian school was the idea of this ascension, right? We're trying to go to Jupiter and beyond the infinite, and that's great. But then there's also, you need to embody, it's like, we're not trying to, if we're just trying to transcend the earthly realm, then we've never made the earthly realm as special and holy as it's supposed to be. And if you're not embodying all these, revelations and all the high esoterica, if you're not bringing it down into your everyday life and figuring out that, how do I make going to the supermarket special? Which, I guess what I said, maybe it's how I perceive the Kautsian angle, because I guess they very much are making the everyday special by finding sinks in the everyday. It's only when it starts to get spelled out as trying to ascend that I get my back up a little bit. But it's interesting because this idea of it's the split between spirit and matter. And coming down the tree is spirit into matter. Going up the tree, we matter into spirit. So we definitely see in the West this desire to reach up into the heavens. And I'm wondering if when we talk about symbolism and synchronicities in movies, if intentional use of symbolism is trying to climb up the tree. Maybe if I can imitate the way in which nature works, I can reach this. I can get closer to a pure spiritual artistic expression, and where in a way the true fool, the idiot who's fresh out of college and writes a screenplay about, you know, spring break or sticking your dick in an apple pie or whatever it is, it's almost allowing truer synchronicity. It's allowing spirit to come into matter because you're so empty. You're a perfect receptacle for the spirit to come down into your matter, whereas the refined artist is trying to make his crude matter into the spiritual. Does that make sense?
That's why Kabbalah literally means to receive. Like, yeah. That's the whole point of that study, is to be receptive. And so that's why you don't want to be like, there's an emphasis in, like, when we were doing Vipassana, where they were saying that don't project images, like don't say what you want to experience. Leave all of that aside. Just go into the body and follow the subtlety of sensation. That's all you're doing. And so, and I recognize the value of that. And the paradox of that is that the more that I go into my body, the more the visuals start showing up on their own, and I'm seeing shit I couldn't dream of, you know. And that was the result of not projecting. So, and that I find fascinating. I think the same thing that's emphasized in serious Kabbalistic study is that you're visualizing these different things and you're exploring it from different angles. You're not wanting to project. There's an emphasis on not wanting to project what you're wanting to see. You just follow and see where it goes, and you're exploring different ideas, but at the same time, you're not saying, this is what it is, make it so. You're like, well, what is it? You know, show me what it is, not let me show the universe what it is, you know?
Well, it's impossible, I think, at least it would have been impossible for me to survive Aleister Crowley's whole body of work without his lectures on yoga and his insistence on its equal importance to all things magical, and that they go hand in hand. And when you get into something very magical, and to put it very grossly, is like a drug experience, something just, you know, a substance acting upon your brain and engaging your adrenaline and your fear and things that are very powerful. If you don't have the grounding ability to still your body, you can go absolutely insane. Conversely, if you're able to still your body and to quiet all your systems and just focus on bodily sensations, it's impossible to imagine just what kind of visual things are going to arise. It's going to surprise you. And going into it, it seems boring and dull and overly disciplined, but just like you said during your Vipassana, that these things emerge out of it that completely take your breath away. So it's a balancing of those two systems. And I think you're right. I think that the explosion out of repression in the 60s of sex, drugs, and rock and roll is just that ever onward ascension into transcendence. But I always think of that one guy, that one hippie in the Woodstock movie who's got, you know, his people sitting in the lotus position telling everyone that you don't need drugs to get high, man. You just need to meditate and you can get higher than any drug in the universe. And I remember the first time seeing that, just thinking of it as just the absolute, that was the wounded warrior, that was what happens to you when you take too many drugs, that you would actually believe just sitting Indian style would lead to whatever, fun and excitement or whatever I thought it was at the time. But having, you know, years upon it to reflect upon it, it all of a sudden falls into place. And so I think that's definitely the danger of our culture right now, is that there are no rules, and, you know, the playground is open to fuck around with all these fantastic substances and relationships and groups, and there are no boundaries anymore. But if you don't have a grounding in the other way, you're going to lose your mind. And I think that's, and you can go further where you want, but I mean, that would seem to be the fertile soil for random terroristic acts or school shootings, and I don't even want to go down that road, but it seems to be somewhat connected, or at least people want people to think that it's connected.
Well, you know, I agree, and this is actually one of the things you guys asked me with the Anthony Peake thing. One of the things I was trying to explain to him, which I feel like, I mean, I've tried to explain this a million times, and I think I was able today to express it in the most sort of concise way that makes sense, is all these things we do are like, we have some sort of knowledge in us somewhere, like unconsciously, subconsciously, noosphere, whatever expression you like. We have this thing that we know we're supposed to be, or we have this urge, I should say, to want to kill the ego, to go to that higher realm. Or we have this urge that we want to, you know, rejoin with Source. We have, it's the idea of the pleasure principle, you know, the death principle. That the idea that we know we have this sort of urge, but we're not really educated and we're confused as fuck as to what that actually means. So we act it out in all these perverted sort of ways. Like, the fact that someone would go out and assassinate someone, and I'm an anarchist, but even I don't support going out and killing a president, you know? It's like, I think there are much better ways to transcend a political system. Regardless, the idea that you would have people having this sort of psychological urge that they can feel only in the sort of periphery of their mind, and they are acting on those urges in very clumsy and kind of ugly ways. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think Woodstock 2 is a perfect example of that.
Well, the same week as Woodstock was the Tate killings. And so that's the phenomenon, like where you have the tragedy and then you have the simultaneous movement toward, like, it's just, there are these two polarities. And so I, you know, talking about the towers, I see it the same way, you know, and even like looking at the juxtaposition between the lovers and then looking at that as Romulus and Remus, in relationship to the tower, which is Mars, that they literally represent a foundation of something new being born. So, you know, there's this idea that at every eon, there's a destruction and there's something else being born out of it. And so when Crowley talks about the book of Revelations, he is expressing that the seers of, you know, back then when they were trying to look into the future and seeing what was coming, anything that was different from their own conceptions terrified them. And so like that story, along with many stories like the virgin being impregnated by a dove, you know, these where you have an animal, basically animal characteristics being given to the child. So these two twins are suckled by a wolf, and so they have this kind, like that kind of thinking belonged to them 2,000 years ago. And to think of us to have a whole other thing is like it brings terror when they actually like peer through the veil into what's in store. And so it makes sense that they're then relating to the Shakina and Zaire as the beast and the Scarlet Woman is something to be afraid of, because they have no basis for comparison. They have no way to relate to it other than in fear, because their awe translates to fear. Does that make sense?
Yeah, very much.
So,
I'm thinking now, you said something that, on the posters for Woodstock, they even pictured a dove, right?
Yeah.
So the dove, when Jesus is baptized by John the Baptist, he says, like, the Spirit descends on him like a dove.
Uh-huh. John, yeah.
Yeah, so I've taken this as the dove, the foaming dove, is the lightning flash 777 of spirit into matter, right? Now,
sure.
And that in Suicide Kings, that's one of the things I talk about, is the idea of this being the dove is the fall of spirit into matter. Now, at the same time, we have the Woodstock Tate killings, all this stuff taking place in tandem with the moon launch in the exact same window of time. So you have, blasting up into space, but what goes up but Apollo? So here you have the classic idea of the hawk and the dove as being the two, like, are you warish or are you peaceful? Are you a dove or a hawk? So here you have the dove is falling, the hawk is rising, and the hawk is solar, Horus, Apollo, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's really interesting, considering in relationship to Scorpio. So you have the death card in tarot, which is actually, once again, the only unnamed card in the major arcana, right? Which is the 13th arcana. It's just the 13th arcana actually expresses that Scorpio is on one level the scorpion, right, which is close to the ground. And then you have the observer consciousness or the witness, where you go deeper into just the sense of I am without being completely identified with the ego, is the eagle, right? Which you, in this case, could relate to Apollo, which, you know, soars above, but is still able to harm, to, it's still a bird of prey. And then you have all, beyond that, the dove, which is the completely, you know, all forgiving, all loving, transcendent self. And so,
does it mean that the eagle has landed?
Right.
Has become the scorpion?
Or the eagle has basically, that we've gotten to another level, we're here, and now there's something else in store for us, perhaps? I don't know. But we've landed on the moon, don't forget, which is...
Right.
You know, and that's in relationship to the sun. And so we reflect on that. It's an interesting thing to meditate on in the first place, being that you have this unnamed card, which is the 13th, and what is it expressing, but going deeper into sensation. Because it's in the sensation that is the sense of I am. This is the basis of, beyond like of either Gyan Yoga or any yoga in Ashtanga is ultimately has the same thing taking place in the midst of whatever the outer expression is, which is going deeper and deeper into the sense of I am until you transcend.
Can I ask you, I had read a yogic book years ago that related the five senses to the five fingers of the hand.
Mm-hmm.
You had started, I keep coming back to this hand thing, seems really poignant to me, and the idea that in Metropolis, which I know you're sort of big into right now, you have the idea of what is the mediator between the hands, the head and the hands, right? So the hands being representative of the five senses, the head being the thing that processes it all, if that makes
totally sense. And the ujjayi related as well. They take the parts of the ujjayi and for the Egyptians, and they related it in the same way. There's an interesting thing where you say, okay, well, you have 14 segments on the hand, and there's this whole thing that yud, the value of the word yud, if you spell it out, the letter yud, if you spell out the letter, you have that equals 14. There's 14 segments that surround the Rosicrucian cross. This is why you have three crosses that are on the Mount of Skulls, right, where Jesus is crucified. And so when you open up, if you close the Rosicrucian cross, then you have the cube. And this is the relationship between Yud, which is the open hand, and Koth, which is the closed hand. Koth corresponds to fortune, while Yud corresponds to the hermit. And so, the Yud is in every letter. The Hebrew alphabet is a flame alphabet because this hand is within every letter, because the hand of God is at work in all of creation, right? And so to have the closed hand, which is Koth, which is fortune, which is Jupiter, is to have the cube, to have the open hand, which is the Yud, which is the teacher who's like, here it is, like he's at the top of the mountain holding the lantern, right? He's, and literally, if you look at the card, you'll see that there's this, the shining star of David, which is the perfect vector, you know? So here you have, you know, Jesus is of the lineage of David, even though he denies it or whatever. However, you don't need to go into that, Melchizedek, whatever. But like, just what is the symbolism and what's being expressed is you have this open and closed hand, the open and the closed cube. What's at the center of the Rosicrucian cross? The rose, which is the heart, is the mediator between the mind and the hands.
now think about this. So if the three crosses are the three hands, well, human beings don't have three hands. But there's the idea of the invisible hand, right? Even when you were talking, Bill, you were talking earlier about Don Draper realizing that there was as high as he could go, almost getting crushed. I was thinking the idea of getting crushed against the glass ceiling, you know, is sort of like marketing terms and business terms. And you have the invisible hand of the marketplace and all this sort of stuff, the third hand. So if Jesus is on the cross, he's on the cross next to thieves, or a thief, right?
Right. Remember, Hermes is a thief, too.
Yes, yes. And Hermes is the god of, he's a god of merchants. So here we have the invisible hand of the marketplace is Mercury, mercantilism, right? People forget that Hermes, Mercury, is the god of commerce. But what I'm thinking is the thief, we have the old school idea of if you are a thief, you get your hand cut off.
Yeah.
So the invisible hand, even fucking Marty in Back to the Future, his hand starts turning invisible.
Right.
This is kind of absurd, but you get what I'm saying. It's like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, that's awesome. And when Luke Skywalker gets his hand cut off by Da'at, his other hand that's left is by extension the hand of Darth Vader or something. I don't know. That's interesting because
he even gets Luke literally gets a replacement hand.
Yeah.
So Luke has three hands.
Yeah.
He's three hand Luke. Cool hand Luke.
Ooh, snap! What we have here is a failure to communicate.
Shall Nekoshet Veshelor Halolekor.